There was a lot of creoles, and there was a lot of mixing going on during that time, and so there was a lot of well-off kind of mixed African-Americans and whites, and so there was just a lot of, you know, and they had money, and so they were just kind of a market to kind of tap into.
Ah, money's the great equalizer.
Exactly. You know, I mean, and before Jim Crow laws came in, you know, and then after they came, these people wanted, were willing to pay a little extra money to kind of live their life before the Jim Crow laws, you know, be able to, you know, go to these certain places that they were able to before it was segregated.
And as a white writer, Grant, did you have any concerns about creating an African-American main character?
I contacted, you know, people I knew, and of course my I was taking, again, that African-American history class, so I asked the teacher many, many questions, like, you know, would you be able to? And
the teacher was black?
Yes. And he, you know, you were able to work, you know, as a, you know, a lawyer if you're black, or and do investigation. You mainly had to do black clients. You
couldn't. Oh, okay. So if you were a black professional, you had to have black clients.
Yeah, you couldn't have white clients. I wasn't so much because I just wanted to get a different viewpoint. And we're constantly kind of today where, you know, I don't know if you remember, you know, the whole Oscars. There was that whole boycott going on.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Because it was
very just, few black nominees,
yeah,
if
and
any.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the complaints is it's just you don't get a different kind of viewpoint from. And so I basically, that was originally my whole angle, is I just wanted a different kind of viewpoint. You know, the white private investigators, there's about, you know, hundreds of stories like that. So I just wanted to get something kind of a fresh perspective, and, you know, and of course the conflict of being able to, you know, do your job when you're having to, you know, fight off racism as well. So I actually, from black readers, I've actually got nothing but praise because they actually are wanting, you know, to read about.
I was going to ask that, yeah. Because I was wondering, it's not uncommon for, say, a white writer to create a black character, or even a man to create a woman character, I guess vice versa, and have somebody say, you're a white man, how can you know what it's like to be black? Mm-hmm. Did you get any of that?
No, and I haven't got any of that because I think mainly it's just, you know, it's just a viewpoint that this is, there's a lot of, you know, for instance, people that just want it, they've just been waiting for something like this, you know, something where, you know, instead of looking on cover and seeing, you know, the same kind of Humphrey Bogart looking, you know, seeing, you know, someone that they, you know, different. And so I think it's just, they just, from what I've gotten the feedback, they're just happy that I written from trying to get their viewpoint, I guess. Mm.
Now, one thing I noticed, William Fletcher is our black main character, Private Eye. He's the book narrator, but his voice in the book, and it's all over the book, you know, he narrates it, plus there's a lot of dialogue. It's free of any noticeable accent, at least it was to me. So it's difficult to tell if he's black based solely on his narration and dialogue. I mean, if somebody picked up the book and didn't know that main chunk of information. What went into your search to find Fletcher's voice on the page?
I didn't want to go and do, like, again, I wanted to
dialect. You didn't want anything like
well,
that.
I gave other characters the dialect, but I didn't want to give him like this, you know, stereotypical dialect. He's a professional and he's not from the South, so he's not going to have a Southern accent. And so I just kind of just gave him this kind of working man kind of narration. And so that's basically what I went from there. I didn't want to go and, you know, start dabbing into, you know, other, I guess, stereotype language, you know?
Oh, I think that works. And he's very educated.
Yeah.
We don't know his background in terms of his education, but he has a very good vocabulary. Mm-hmm. He's very observant. And I think we learn about him through his observations, through his actions, certainly, but not his dialogue. Mm-hmm. So that was a conscious choice not to do that. The funny thing, when you mentioned that, you know, he doesn't have a Southern accent. I was listening to prepare for the interview. There's an audiobook of The Red Storm, and the narrator in the audiobook actually gives him a little Southern inflection.
I absolutely love the audiobook. And I'm not just, you know, I...
Oh, no, he's a great reader, but I was surprised... I didn't get that when I read the book before listening to the audio portion.
His choice was basically he had been living in the city so long that he basically would pick up something.
A little bit of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And it, plus, as a reader, he probably wanted to give it some flair versus just this, you know. And so I absolutely love the artistic choice. Yeah, I noticed that too. And
oh, so that was not something you played a part of. You said, okay, let's give him a little Southern accent.
No, I didn't have anything to do with the audio. What I found interesting is that Blackstone Audio is actually out of Ashland, Oregon.
Oh,
I didn't know that.
Is that where it was actually recorded then?
The narrator
was there.
Mm-hmm, the narrator's actually.
Oh, you could have gone to the studio.
I know, I could have. He was actually, you know how they have the Elizabethan festivals there?
Oh, certainly. The Shakespeare festival.
Yeah. I guess he's one of a very prominent actor in the Ashland area. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is he black, by the way?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And really, there's no black accent there.
No.
And I'm going, you know, by stereotypes that you see in a lot of media. There's just that kind of slight Southern inflection.
Yeah.
So probably a little bit of a New Orleans accent. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Grant Bywaters, author of the new mystery novel, The Red Storm. In addition to being a private eye, and of course, we talked about you have some experience in that profession. William Fletcher is also a former heavyweight boxer, and we mentioned in New York City is where he had his fights. And that was when the book began, so that's the Jazz Age, the 1920s. Do you have any experience in that field, in boxing?
I'm a huge boxing fan. I've actually written some boxing articles for some online boxing sites and stuff.
So. Oh, so current boxers.
Yeah, current boxers.
Because the sport's in quite a bit of a decline, compared to the 20s.
Yeah, I mean, back then it was like the biggest sport in the world.
Even about 50 years ago, it was huge.
Yeah, and so I've always been kind of a fight fan and boxing fan, so it just came kind of naturally.
Now, why did you create William Fletcher as a former boxer? I read somewhere you said that you envisioned him as a Sonny Liston type in terms of his actual physique.
Yes. Because basically boxing at that time was, if you're African-American, it was really the only sport you could do to make money. And it was one of the only sports that was pretty much not segregated. Basically, Jack Johnson became the first heavyweight champion at the turn of the century. And he was, you know, if you know anything about Jack Johnson, way ahead of his time.
Oh, yes. There were movies based on
that. On his movie.
The Great White Hope.
Yeah, The Great White Hopes, absolutely. Mm. And so after Johnson, you know, was defeated by one of the Hopes, they basically drew the color line.
Like, was that Jeffries?
No, it wasn't Jeffries. He beat Jeffries. I mean, he bleed him to a pulp. It was Willard in, I think, 1910 in Cuba. And there's a lot of speculation that Johnson threw the fight because basically he fled the country because they charged him with a bogus law called the Mann Act, which basically—
Taking a woman across state line.
And it was his wife.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. And so they've been trying to pardon that. I believe the Johnson estate were very disappointed that Obama hadn't done that. They were basically wanting to pardon.
Oh, I didn't know he wasn't pardoned yet.
He hadn't been pardoned.
I mean, the Great White Hope goes into all that.
Yeah,
persecuted by the government.
Yeah, and they wanted to pardon him. It's just kind of like, you know, right or wrong after so many years, just for his family. I don't think he had kids, but I think he has like nieces or nephews. And so they believe that some theories is that he threw the fight so he could come back to the United States and get a leaner sentence. So he lost, and basically, I think it was from 1910 till when Joe Louis showed up in the late 1930s, they wouldn't let any black heavyweights.
So what was it like in the 20s when Fletcher was boxing in New York early in the book? That's basically the first chapter.
Yeah, basically the champ back then was Jack Dempsey. Mm-hmm. And there was a few actual really good black heavyweights.
Gene Tunney, that era.
Yeah, there was some really good black heavyweights that were the number one contender that just never got a shot.
And is that because they were prevented from getting a shot?
They were preventing from getting a shot because Tex Rickard, who was a very famous promoter, and I believe he created Madison Square Garden, or he had a huge part in it. And that's because, you know, for boxing, now you think basketball, but back then,
Boxing was a much bigger sport.
And basically,
than the NBA.
You know, what they're fearing is Jack Johnson basically almost ruined the heavyweight title because nobody would, you know, wanted to go to the fights. And when he fled the country, he was still a champ. So he would do heavyweight title fights like in France, who are, again, very, in that time period, much more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, pretty much blacks were
a lot of jazz musicians fled to France to make a living.
Yeah. And so they just would not allow, you know, a black heavyweight to take the title.
And we should mention, too, that the boxing part of William Fletcher's career early on plays a big part because he realized he couldn't get anywhere. He couldn't get beyond, a few preliminary fights. He could never be heavyweight champion of the world, which he wanted. So he just kind of gave it up and switched careers.
Yeah, he could not get a title fight, and he's basically stuck fighting the same bums over and over again, and, you know, pretty much not getting, you know, unless he knocked the guy out, he'd probably not win a decision, so.
And so we go from the 1920s in the first chapter to, I think, the second chapter, where in New Orleans all of a sudden, and about 15 years later, the year is 1938, William Fletcher now, his boxing days are behind him, and he's a private eye, as we mentioned. And now, you mentioned before, you picked New Orleans because it's one of your favorite cities. And I noticed in the book, there's a lot of very detailed descriptions, where Fletcher lives in the French Quarter. One of the gangs in the book has a rundown hotel in the warehouse district. I've been to New Orleans, so I know some of these sites. Did you then actually visit New Orleans and do the research there, take notes?
Yes. I've been there before I wrote the story and stuff, so obviously. But then I did some trips just to go out there and get an idea. So I basically, you know, took a trip down there and just basically kind of just jotted down street names and stuff and areas that I kind of had in my mind.
Actual buildings at those
addresses? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And why'd you have them living in the French Quarter there? That was kind of the center of things. Yeah, I go to New Orleans now, and that's, of course, where all the tourists are. And you got drunk people, you know, at 2 a.m. with their hurricanes walking down the street. That wouldn't be William Fletcher territory today.
Again, because it was very liberal, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And so they allowed it. And I believe I explained in the book, basically, his landlord basically realized there was a lot of money to be gained in, you know, catering to minorities.
I think one of the pleasures of the book is his ingenuity at getting around a lot of the discrimination, segregation, and Jim Crow laws. And part of it is money, of course, with a landlord, but part of it, he has some good connections.
And that's private investigation work. I mean, it's basically what people don't understand is it's not like in the movies where, you know, you can just go and grab somebody and interrogate them and stuff.
That's to rough them up a little.
Yeah, you have no legal authority at all. The only difference between a regular citizen and a private investigator is they can get paid. That's the only difference, paid to do investigation work versus like an amateur. So you basically, nobody's entitled to answer anything you want or do anything you want. Mm-hmm. And so you basically have to build up, you know, connections and make yourself basically irreplaceable. You know, like, you know, this guy's invaluable. We can't just toss him to the side, you know. And that's basically how Fletcher is. He's basically realized that if you make yourself irreplaceable and very valuable, you know, you can kind of, you know, move.
And he has some helpful friends there.
There's exactly. Well,
a Jewish police sergeant, Brawley.
Yeah.
And then, a very elite New Orleans lawyer who has some pretty good political connections.
Well, exactly. And again, he basically persuades them, shows them how valuable he can be. You know, basically, first a cop, he can go and get information that, you know, a white cop in black areas can't get, you know. And, you know, with the lawyer and stuff, he can go and the lawyer realized that he's a really good investigator and can go and find clients, you know, witnesses that he needs, you know. And so basically it's like, this guy's too valuable to be sitting in jail. So we got to keep him out of jail.
Now it's, we can't really talk too much more about the book because I don't want to give anything away. There's a lot of plot twists, and I think it's very important for the reader to go in not knowing those twists in advance. But there was one point in the book, there's a plot twist that involves homosexuality, as if race relations wasn't enough. And you talk about discrimination. Well, actually, there's still quite a bit of that involved, but much worse, you know, in 1938. So the book explores quite a bit about prejudice, discrimination, certainly in that era. Was that something you wanted to do beyond the entertainment value of the story itself?
Absolutely. Basically, I want to say that, you know, if you read the old, like, detective novels and stuff, they put it in there, but they actually couldn't say it, so they used other words. If you read The Maltese Falcon, I believe, if you ever read the book, Joe Cairo was homosexual.
And and very clear, that's Peter Lorre.
Yeah, and I think the other version. One, Wilma, was homo, and they called him a gunsel.
You know, I looked that up today because you have a lot of 30 slang in there.
Yeah.
So I had a web page with 30 slang, and Gunsel I recognize because they always call Wilma that. It was Elisha Cook Jr. in the Maltese Falcon. And they said Gunsel was a gunman, obviously, but also kind of a young, impetuous person. Uh-huh. Or possibly homosexual.
Yep.
And I figured, okay, well, I could see that with Wilma. You know, he did have kind of a crush on some of the other gangsters, but that's not something they could really make clear in the movie.
And same with The Big Sleep. A big plot point that people don't understand is the main character that was blackmailing, you know, taking nude pictures of this wealthy man's daughter,
right,
actually had a romance with the chauffeur. And that's why he exacted revenge. Well, if you watch the movie, because they can't really elaborate on that because it's 1940s.
They actually had something called the Hays Code.
Exactly.
That's where scripts had to be approved before they shot the movie. They're very heavily censored. Now, the big question that you've got this great character now, William Fletcher, our black private eye in 1930s New Orleans. Is there another William Fletcher book in the works?
Yes. The publisher wants another one.
Ah.
So I will
You better deliver then if the publisher wants one.
Yeah. I went back to school to finish up my bachelor's in psychology. Uh-huh. And it was actually around the time I was starting back up that I got the letter telling me that I won the competition. So it's like, you know. And so,
were you in class at the time?
No, I was just getting ready for class. Oh. It was in the fall of 2014.
Probably didn't hear a word in that class after that day, huh?
Yeah,
you must have been floating.
Yeah, so I will be finishing up really soon, but I will not. I'm not doing any classes this summer, and I'm just going to be devoted to starting.
So you've got the story and the idea.
Yeah, I do got a very kind of. More than just a general idea. I got kind of basically all I can say is right now is that his days in the rings are not over, I guess. There'll be consequences.
We've been talking with Grant Bywaters, author of the new mystery novel, The Red Storm. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers for KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Grant for visiting us at KBOO and for all of you for listening.
I hope they don't hang you, Precious, for that sweet neck.
You're not.
Yes, Angel, I'm going to send you over. The chances are you'll get off with life. That means if you're a good girl, you'll be out in 20 years. I'll be waiting for you. If they hang you, I'll always remember you.
Take it from me. Someday we'll all be free.
Join us Sunday night, July 10th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Soul Music and Politics. We will celebrate the life and music of Mr. Donny Hathaway. We will also deconstruct the at-large voting process in Multnomah County and Portland, Oregon that keeps the status quo power elite in power. Sunday night for Soul Music and Politics, July 10th from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Crop Up Dinner Series and Market Showcase. The Aurora Dinner will be held July 21st from 5:30 to 9 p.m. The dinner series lets you dine on dishes built around Oregon's specialty crops that are grown in the local regions surrounding each dinner site. It has been designed to increase awareness of the bountiful diversity of Oregon's specialty crops, including fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, dried fruits, and nursery crops. Again, that's the Crop Up Dinner Series and Market Showcase, July 21st from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at 15210 Northeast Miley Road in Aurora. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kabu.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
This is the July edition of...